Chapter 3.
You sent for me, Your Majesty?
I did, Belcazar. Close the door behind you. Cressa didn't want any of her overly curious retinue listening in on their conversation. Belcazar complied and took a chair at the table across from the Queen. He was a husky man, pockmarked, with hair crimped into tight curls, light brown but streaked with amber when hit by the light. Now in his 50s, he moved carefully, thought deliberately, and talked precisely, so that consulting him often drove Cressa to distraction. But she had learned to value his analysis. His family held a mid-size estate in Vitorine, and years ago he had travelled to Cascada to entreat Queen Katrina to adopt a more equitable tax formula on landowners large and small. This formula impressed her mother because it quelled many irritating complaints. Later, she asked him to come up with a solution for clogged drainage ditches. The lattice screens he designed were still in use all around Weirendale. Queen Katrina had appointed him to her circle council 12 years ago. Cressa had asked him to continue serving. Indeed, out of all her councillors, she trusted him the most. I received this missive. I would like your opinion on it. Belcazar nodded and without fuss began to read the long document she placed before him. His grey eyes paused over every word, so Cressa sat alone with her thoughts. She wished she could ask her mother's opinion. Katrina the Strategist, the people now called her. Her talent had become blazingly obvious early on when, as a toddler, she bested all adults in oblongs and squares. Cressa judged her own talent a paltry weapon for the present circumstances. At the comparatively late age of 6 summers, her mother had taken her to Roatag, the former royal chronicler, for her own definition. Her mother had told him, "The Princella is able to change people's memories." The ancient functionary had tested this assertion. He had called in a young assistant, asking him to fetch a certain herb they all saw from the window. When he returned, Cressa had been asked to erase the assistant's memory of his errand. She had climbed down off her chair and touched his dry, ink-stained hand. When questioned, the man vehemently denied that he had left his work desk all morning. Showing him the stalks of chives and the mud on his boots did not bring back his recall. How well Cressa remembered that later that afternoon, her mother had taken her outside to see that the Queen's flag, silver droplets falling into a silver river on a backing of blue silk, had been hoisted onto the top of the palace and had rippled in the wind. Some talents were publicly announced, others, especially related to enchantment, were kept private to increase a queen's opportunities to learn to wield them. But at least everyone knew that Nargis had graced Cressa with its favour. Roatag explained that Cressa's talent was a variety of enchantment. He had spoken at length about other queens in Weirendale's past who were also enchanters, though their specific abilities varied. One had been a memory enhancer. She could make people remember in minute detail events they had forgotten. Another was a compeller. She could force people to act against their will. Still another queen could read people's thoughts. Often, over time, enchanters developed several ways of affecting people's minds and memories. Cressa grasped how compelling would be useful. She would just compel the Ormandians to do as she bid, though she always needed to be touching her subject. Would she have to touch all the citizens of Oromondo? But making people forget had not as yet proven particularly useful. As a child, she had sometimes made Nana forget that she had already had her candied fruit and she would get another one. Thus far, she had had few real occasions to practice her talent for something of consequence. Belcazar had only turned over half the pages. Cressa stood and paced around her comfortably appointed private audience chamber, her closet with its deep blue rug and white velvet wall hangings. Plink. The water feature in this room, named the Weeping Swan, was a glass and gold bowl above which rose an enamelled swan's neck and head. The beak dropped one drop of Nargis water at a time. Usually, Cressa no longer registered the sound of the droplets. Her mother had been the strategist, always looking five steps ahead, calculating what would happen before her every move. Katrina had married the widowed King Nithanel of Lothrod, because she deduced that someday an alliance with Lothrod would be of utmost importance to Weirendale. Plink. Ironically, the only thing Katrina had not seen in advance was that she herself would die in her prime. Caprice struck with random cruelty, heedless of the harm it wreaked. Katrina's horse had been stopped in a gopher hole and thrown her. She had broken her neck and died instantaneously, a look of surprise frozen on her face. Cressa had been only 23 summers. She had been 5 moons into her pregnancy with Cerulea. She had not felt ready to assume the throne. She had wanted some years of private life. She did not feel ready now for this challenge. Plink. Finally, Belcazar deliberately straightened all the pages, then straightened them again and moved them to the side. He drummed his fingers on the table one at a time. The Queen stifled her urge to scream at him and sat down on the opposite side of the glossy mahogany table.
"Troubling," he said.
"I realise."
"This was hand delivered this morning?"
"Yes."
"Did the servant see who brought it? Did Envoy Thumb come himself?"
"I don't know. Why does that matter?"
"Well,"
said Belcazar thoughtfully,
"perchance it doesn't, but we have received other communiques from Thumb, and this doesn't convey the same tone."
Plink. "What do you mean?"
"Thumb shows belligerence and aggression, like all Oros."
Cressa often found it impossible not to fill in Belcazar's pauses, though doing so never sped up his delivery. He nodded.
"Oromondo has been a militaristic realm forever and a day. It respects discipline above all."
"This is not surprising," said Cressa. "Their country is volcanic, and the populace must be taught to heed warnings of eruptions. And they rely on mining, a venture that requires strength and fearlessness." Belcazar nodded slowly, looking at his fingernails as if the answers to all the world's troubles were written in their ridges. "Plink," he continued.
"But in past years, we have always been able to treat with them. Oh, he'll evoke the great divinity of their eight magi and chastise us for being non-believers. But that rhetoric merely covered his true goal. Since the War of the Priests, we have traded amicably.
Balcazar took out his handkerchief, blew his nose, and deliberately put the kerchief back in his sleeve. Plink.
Cressa massaged her forehead with her fingertips in impatience. We suspect Oromondo has been paying the Pelish pirate fleet to raid for foodstuffs, but we have found no proof. But here,
Balcazar pointed to a passage,
and here, the religious zeal rings so fervent,
he read aloud.
Ye have offended the Magi and pure Oromondians with thy putrid heathen practices. Weakling scum of the earth, reeking with corruption, soiled with thy guilt, worshippers of water, idolaters of a line of witch bastards, rats puffed up with trifling vanities and unclean luxuries, the Magi will tolerate thy meddling no longer.
I skipped over those flourishes, she said. I think the crux of the matter lies in the rice shipments. The rice, they claim, was poisoned. The rice, they say, caused stillbirths and drove cows mad. Plink.
The rice wasn't poisoned,
said Balcazar.
Could someone somehow have tampered with it?
Balcazar rubbed between his brows with a forefinger, and Cressa again became conscious of the drip of the water.
Plink. Consider, Your Majesty, how much poison it would take to taint four full holds of grain. And mix it through. Hardly probable. And to what end?
More finger drumming.
Nevertheless, before the full circle meets, let's inquire if any of the shipmasters rest in port. And question the grain merchant.
The circle meets after noonday, so I will send the messages now. Cressa went to the door and spoke to her servants. I hardly think, she said as she turned back to Balcazar, that Thumb or anyone would simply invent the notion of women losing their babes.
But one does not feed rice to milk cows,
he countered. They might, if they had no other grain. Look, you, what do we know about Oromondo? For some years it has groaned under mysterious blights and suffered a food shortage. That is why they trade for foodstuffs. Didn't Tenny tell us that the Oros have numerous procurement contracts with the Free States?
True, replied Balcazar.
A long pause while each finger struck the wood.
These blights, these illnesses, no one knows their cause.
But why blame us?
Plink. Belcazar repeated, drumming each finger on the table.
Why do villagers turn on their neighbours when misfortune strikes? People need answers, and they will blame whomever they suspect wishes them ill. Someone paranoid wrote this letter, someone bursting, exploding with religious zeal.
I don't think it matters who dictated it. What matters is that Oromondo demands that I relinquish the throne. We return the gold and the jewels they sent, and we send 8 more ships full of grain on tomorrow's tide, or it will declare war on us.
Yes, he said. You've got the meat of it.
Then he went on to recite a passage from the letter.
Thy streets will run with blood. Thy witch will meet justice. We will take what we are owed by the force of the Magi's glorious power.
What shall we do?
Cressa's face stiffened with anger.
Hmm? Do? About what?
Any of it. All of it.
Belcazar, whom she knew to be a peaceable, imperturbable man, for once answered quickly,
We prepare for war.
Plink. Queen Cressa steadied herself for a moment before entering the circle chamber where her council awaited her. Over the last year, more and more she dreaded meetings with this group. Oh, she trusted Belcazar and sweet, elderly General Jürgen, but lately she guessed that her councillors didn't always tell her the full truth, or that they met separately to strategize how to handle her. And all shrank away from any physical contact with her, as if they had heard a whisper about her talent and feared her touch. Steward Matwick, the councillor she had once leaned upon the most, had to be the head of the opposition. Or at the least, she could not imagine the others working against her without his tacit approval. She could be mistaken in her suspicions. She had the authority to dismiss her circle, but such a drastic step would require that she present incontrovertible evidence of crimes to the court and the populace. And she had precious few allies. The underlying problem, she knew, lay in how little time she had spent in Cascada and how little time in court. She had not won her subjects' personal loyalty. They held little true regard for her, either as a woman or as their queen. When Katrina died, Cressa had abruptly succeeded a ruler who was known and respected for her sagacity. Cressa herself had never earned their acceptance, much less their esteem or love, other than by virtue of her birth and station. Well, it will not do to dally in the hallway any longer, in front of my watching ladies in waiting. Cressa raised her chin and told Duchess Aubrey to announce her.
Your Majesty,
the 6 councillors murmured as they bowed and curtsied. They stood around the council table in the high-ceilinged round turret room, the winter morning chill chased away by fireplaces at both sides. Queen Cressa crossed to her high-backed chair, cushioned in blue velvet, at the honey-coloured oak table shaped like a hollowed-out circle. By some earlier monarch's design, she had her back to the light coming in the mullioned transoms so that it shone full on her counsellors' faces. Water flowed constantly in a circular pool in the middle of the table, creating a light background murmur. She seated herself, and General Jürgen pushed her chair closer.
"You may be seated," she said. "I take it you have investigated this situation?"
Lord Steward Matwick, placed on her right, ran these meetings because he held the highest rank on the council. In Weirendale, the country's landowners elected a steward every 10 years. Matwick was a handsome man of medium height and graceful build, with soulful dark grey eyes and short mid-brown hair boasting only a few threads of amber. He habitually wore well-tailored but modest attire, usually of muted colour.
"Your Majesty,"
Matwick said as he took the floor with an incline of his head,
"I hope you are not distressed. How wise of you to turn this matter over to us."
For many years, Matwick's compliments and concern for her well-being had soothed away any disquiet Cressa harboured. Today, however, she found herself more immune to his charm. "What have you discovered?" she asked, just a tad abruptly.
"We have interrogated the grain merchant and the seamaster of one of the trade ships. The merchant and her family have been eating rice from the same shipment for moons with no sign of illness. No other customer has complained about the rice being tainted. She has supplied many shops, even the palace, with this fool's harvest. In point of fact, we have all eaten from her granaries. Moreover, we found one of the shipmasters of the transport in port. He swears that no one went down in the hold from the time the rice was loaded until the ship reached harbour, and the ship made no unscheduled stops. So, we have looked into this matter thoroughly and found nothing amiss. I conclude the charges are specious."
"I cannot fault your logic," Cressa said. "But then why has Oromondo sent such a challenge?"
"Your Majesty, forgive me,"
Matwick continued,
"but we know the Oros better than you do. This bluff is in decidedly poor taste, but not a cause for anguish."
Belcazar broke in.
"I have already said my piece, Matwick. You know, I disagree. I believe that the army must be mustered now and all defensive measures put in place. We can't take the Oros lightly, and this letter contains outright threats.
But Belcazar, your Majesty," said Duchess Latley,
vigorously shaking her double chins, her uncovered hair coiffed in an elaborate ringlet style too young for her advancing years. Her hair shone the gold, orange, tan colour commonly described as amber. On many noble heads, the amber strands interwove with brown, but if Latley grew any brown hairs, she had her maid pluck them out.
"I do believe that they have sent threats of this ilk in past years under dear Katrina's rule. She could not be taunted into overreaction, and I do trust that you will follow her wisdom."
"What do you mean by overreaction, Duchess?" asked Cressa, miffed by Latley's air of superiority.
Latley always grated on Cressa because she had served as her mother's lady-in-waiting for a year and habitually presumed on this slight connection.
"Just that we would hate for you to muster the army or cause all sorts of uproar over this scrap of rubbish. and any military move would mean that you would have to raise tithes, dear Majesty. And that would be so unfortunate, even unwise. We would hate for you to have to do that again so soon after the ambitious road project you advocated last year.
As I recall, Duchess, this council unanimously and enthusiastically approved the repair of the royal roadways. Are you saying now that you begrudge the monies? Cressa recognised that behind the polite words lay a threat. If you raise levies on the gentry, you will alienate them.
By the way, she continued, hoping to sound like Queen Katrina, but fearing she mimicked Cerulea on a petulant day, didn't I ask to see the account books on that project some time ago?
You may have, admitted Councillor Presian, who served as the royal treasurer, a narrow-shouldered, somewhat dull young man whose prematurely thinning hair, the dead brown of a frozen dirt path, was too lank to hold the curled style popular among courtiers and fell lifeless into his pudding face.
If so, please accept my most abject apologies, Your Majesty. An accident with the wine glass spoiled some pages. I will get the ledgers to you as soon as...
Presian! Tusk, tusk!
Matwick interrupted in a mock scolding tone.
Send for the ledgers this instant. That is, if in the present serious circumstances your Highness would still like to satisfy your curiosity...
How much have they padded those expenses? Dare I push this issue today? Cressa assumed what she intended as an icy stare. Let us return to the issue at hand, which is not roads, nor taxes, nor monies, nor account books, but the Oromondo grievances and threats. Is there aught we can or should do to reason with or placate them? What response do we offer?
General Jürgen coughed into his age-spotted hand.
We might consider sending them a shipment of rice, gratis. That would be a gesture toward peaceful relations. If you calculate the price, any mobilization or hostilities would end up costing all of us much more than a shipload of rice.
Matwick steepled his hands, a characteristic gesture that connoted his thoughtfulness. He had long and shapely fingers. He kept his hands spotlessly clean and reportedly asked his valet to sand his nails nightly. The other councillors, who coveted his approval, looked to him for his reaction. But Belcazar broke in.
No amount of rice will make up for lost babes. Or what they see as deliberate insults toward their sacred magi.
Cressa agreed with Belcazar, but she had no chance to say so, for Matwick was already speaking.
Oh, Belcazar, do you want us to return the two emeralds and the sapphire too?
Matwick gave a wry chuckle.
My friends, we need not placate. We just ignore this screed. The Oros will see our silence as a sign of strength. They may bully other countries, but we cannot be baited or intimidated. In my considered opinion, they will go back to mining their metals and bowing down to their magi and leave us alone until their need for grain forces them to recommence trading, in which case we may be able to make more favourable terms. Oromondo lies hundreds of leagues away. It doesn't have a navy. Unless... my esteemed friend, you fear the Magi's magic powers.
Cressa suspected that the Magi's powers should not be sneered at. But she felt boxed in by Matwick's dismissal because to say so now might make her sound weak or frightened.
The army's force is always at your disposal, Your Majesty,
General Jurgen quietly interjected into the awkward silence. The Queen looked at the two councillors who had not yet spoken. Lady Tenny, her counsellor for diplomacy, a sharp-nosed, well-travelled woman whose hair was pulled back in a severe style, showing the rusty amber at the temples and the chocolate brown of her widow's peak. And Lord Retzel, bushy-browed and hard of hearing, but the largest landowner in the realm. Lord Retzel spoke first.
I agree with Matwick, eh? He's investigated. He's added everything together. He's so clever. I agree completely. Your Majesty.
Lord Retzel spoke, as always, too loudly and too forcefully, as if bluster would compensate for lack of brains. Of course you do. You serve as his lapdog, or, if occasion warrants it, his bulldog. I hate the way you thunder at me. Lady Tenny made a snort, conveying that the whole meeting had been a waste of time.
Your Majesty, we have gone round and round on these issues. May I make a suggestion? Before you decide what action to take,
she held up her hands to ward off interruption,
if any, we might demand an audience with Envoy Thumb and see what he has to say. Questioning him might offer us more information. We might at least,
here she inclined her head in Belcazar's direction,
be able to determine if he himself wrote the ultimatum, or if he just acts as messenger from the Magi.
Lady Tenny's diplomatic proposal made sense, but most of all, it provided a way for Cressa to escape this room. She did not know which was worse, the way her counsellors cajoled, talked over, or threatened her.
Very well, Lady Tenny, she replied,
working to keep her voice steady and her tone calm.
Pray arrange an audience with Thumb tomorrow. After Tenny, Belcazar, Jurgen and I question him, I will discuss this matter with the Circle once more.
How wise you've grown, my queen,
Matwick smiled as he spoke. But Cressa was not at all sure whether the compliment was genuine or patronising.
Rest assured that I will never overreact,
she spoke with an edge in her voice. But neither will I overlook threats to our sovereignty, nor insults to the throne. Cressa rose to the top of her paltry height and swept out of the room. She was trembling, but she hoped they would not notice.